Well, this is Mental Health Radio. Take it from us, and that's our theme music from Joe Cocker called Respect Yourself, which has some great messages about respecting ourselves and others. So I'm host Sheldon Brown with technician Declan Curran, and Mental Health Radio is brought to you and funded by Ember Wellbeing Trust. Now, today's broadcast is our third consecutive radio show on the issues of suicide and suicide prevention. On Tuesday, July 23, we compared the discrepancy between funding for suicide prevention and road safety. And despite deaths from suicide being almost double that of the road toll, spending on suicide prevention attracts only $40 million compared to the $1.4 billion for road safety. So last week, after that show, last week we examined another issue surrounding suicide, the injustice faced by bereaved families of suicide who are looking not only for closure but also some recognition that psychiatric services have let their loved ones down. So today we talk to two advocates seeking justice, Corinda Taylor of Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust and Leanne Marshall, a bereaved parent of suicide with considerable experience of the mental health system. So welcome to you both. Corinda is on the phone from Dunedin, and Leanne, you're in the studio, and you are doing your first radio interview, which is quite a big deal.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Sheldon. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, good, well, lovely to have you here. And one of the things that you said to me just before we came into the studio, that in fact you haven't told your story other than some informal chat that we had at the Ember offices.
That's right.
Yeah, so how are you feeling about being in the studio?
A little bit nervous, but I'll be okay.
You're okay, good. So what is your experience following the loss of your son, and how long ago was that?
That was back in 2016. I feel that he was let down by the mental health services during... my son was 21 years old. It was his first admission into mental health. Prior to that, he was starting to spiral and become unwell. And the tragedy is that the very system that was meant to be set up to help him actually let him down badly.
So where did he get help in the mental health services? Was it in a acute psychiatric unit?
Yeah, he ended up in the acute psychiatric ward.
Right. And so how long was he there before the tragedy occurred?
3 weeks.
So that wasn't very long.
No. So he was 2 years beginning to become unwell. By the time he was picked up by the mental health services, was a couple of years later at the age of 21. And like I said, you know, that's where he should have been able to get help. But it actually led to his demise.
So... are you okay about talking about his demise? Because some of the things that we've chatted about earlier are coming back to me, and I recall that he escaped from this acute psychiatric unit.
Yes.
But wasn't found for many days.
6 weeks.
And in fact, where was he? Where was he eventually found?
He was just found over the fence line from where he escaped from the mental health acute ward.
So what explanation have you had as to why it took 6 weeks to find him?
Well, it was a bit... it was a police search, actually, and it was fumbled by both the DHB and the police during that time.
So how was it for you in this terrible time of not knowing what had happened?
Well, as you could imagine, extremely upsetting, yeah.
And so now you're 3 years down the track, and what's the level of upset today?
Well, basically everything's been put on hold because in the early stages I did my coroner's report. Like, I had documented everything. I had a paper trail. Everything was evidenced because I had begun making complaints against the system while he was still in the system. Like, there's lots of things that went on in there that were not conducive to his recovery. There was lots of bullying and things like that, there was complaints made back then. But everything has been put on hold until we get that coroner's report, and that this is coming on 3 years later with no closure.
Well, let's just go to Corinda. Does this sound familiar to you, Corinda?
It's horrific. And yes, it does sound very familiar. And Leanne, I am so sorry for your loss.
Thanks,
I'm
Corinda.
So sorry that you have to go through this, and I'm so sorry for what your son experienced.
Yes, thanks.
Yeah, well, I know that Leanne in an email thanked you, Corinda, and said, I think, thank God for people like Corinda who are prepared to campaign to try and get some improvements. So you may not have met, but I think there's quite a close bond between the two of you.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah. And we will certainly catch up afterwards.
That sounds good.
So, Corinda, you've been seeking justice for almost 6 years, so that's twice the time that Leanne has been waiting. What were the circumstances surrounding the loss of your son?
Actually, it's about 6.5 years now later, Sheldon, and it will probably still take more than a year for everything to be put aside. I don't think I'll ever find closure, not because it took so long and because the people that were involved just denied any wrongdoing. However, the circumstances surrounding Ross's death is very similar to yours story, Leanne. Ross also had a 2-year prodromal period. He also ended up in acute services under the Mental Health Act. He stayed in the services for about a month. And like your story, the very service that was set up to help my son Ross also let him down.
Mm.
And, you know, we made our complaints. We went through the Health and Disability Commission to make our complaint. It took them 4 years to investigate, and it was 4 years of arguing every single point because the DHB did their own investigation. They investigated themselves, and lo and behold, they found no fault with themselves.
Mm.
So when you say they investigated themselves, it wasn't an independent investigation?
No, it wasn't. They appointed colleagues to investigate close colleagues. That's basically what an investigation is at the DHB. And, of course, you're unlikely to squeal on your colleague because there, by the grace of God, go I, because next week it would be me that's being investigated, they go. So, you know, they investigate each other the whole time. But to get back to the commissioner's finding, he actually they appointed an independent expert psychiatrist who did a really thorough investigation, and
that was for the he was working for the Health and Disability Commission.
Yes,
right.
I think they contract them. They you know they work elsewhere, but they contract them to do these investigations, and she came back and she said it was a female that the DHB and the psychiatrist departed severely from expected standards of care, and that they breached code 4 of the Health and Disability Codes. So it kind of validated everything that we said all along, and yet they were still going on that they won't accept fault, basically. They were made to apologize, and that's a whole long story in itself. We didn't get the apology because the psychiatrist basically didn't accept the findings.
So we've had, last week we mentioned the case of Nikki Stevens, who was allowed to walk out of an acute psychiatric unit at Waikato Hospital. I think it's called the Henry Rongomai Bennett unit. He has actually had an apology. And does that give you any hope? Well, Leanne, do you feel any more hope because of that apology?
I don't know about hope, because that's an awful long time to wait for an apology. This is one thing I also find in the system, that there's a lack of accountability, and there appears to be a cover-up mentality, you know, where they do close ranks and protect themselves, and we, as the bereaved families, are left trying to pick up the shattered pieces.
Well, one of the things I think you've said in your petition is that there's a terrible unfair balance, Corinda, in that the taxpayer pays for all the legal costs and expenses related to the DHB or the authority, but there is no legal support for those people who have been aggrieved.
Absolutely. And, you know, you imagine you take a broken family that are already traumatised by what has happened, and we need to make a complaint. It takes all your energy. It takes the emotional cost is so high. I mean, that's just taking, not even mentioning the financial cost, because, you know, we had to get lawyers involved because it was just so hard to make the complaint stick. We fought so hard to get that complaint to stick. And it takes a lot of energy, a lot of emotional energy to do that.
And you say in your petition, this is at a time when you are grieving and at your most vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we actually also appealed the internal investigation at the Southern DHB, and again, they go, nothing to see here, you know, we did nothing wrong. So we really took it to the extreme to test ourselves to see how things, you know, it becomes so defensive that if you become that defensive, you can't actually fix what is wrong in the system. You have to recognize and own it. If you've made a mistake, own it, fix it.
So, Leanne, one of the realities of this, of your case, is that your son was able to exit the acute psychiatric unit, which is usually a lockdown area, isn't it?
Yes.
So is that one of the concerns that you have, that he wasn't kept safe and secure?
That's right. He, on the same night, he was able to escape. He self-presented to the police. They took him back and they left him to it, and he escaped again that same night, and that's when he took his life.
So he actually was able to leave the acute psychiatric unit, which is supposed to be a safe and lockdown place. He escaped twice in that same night.
Yes. The second time with a sheet.
So have they got, like with Nikki Stevens, have they got any video footage showing?
They say they don't, but it would be very hard to leave that place with a sheet and not be picked up by some sort of CCTV footage.
I mean, my experience of visiting people in extreme psychiatric units is that if I'm, issued into the place, the only way I can get out is for a nurse to allow me out and provide the access out of the building. Does that not apply to patients?
I'm not sure. We're still waiting for an outcome.
Right. So that outcome is a coronial investigation, and why does it take so 3 years in your case and 6 years, I think, in Corinda's case, to get some sort of finality?
the reasons that we're getting from the coroners is that there's a backlog, and I think they have a shortage of coroners. That's the only... I get an email every year to say that there's still some time. They're working on it. Please be patient.
So you get... That's the only communication you have. Where does that email come from?
From the coroner that's working on the case.
So once a year... the coroner updates you, basically.
Unless I send an email to her, I get a response back.
Right, so they will respond.
Yep.
Have you addressed any of your complaints with the coroner and tried to guide her in terms of the priorities that you see?
I have sent her everything, like pages of stuff. I've got paper trails. That I've sent her and made requests, yes.
Right. And how responsive has the coroner been in relation to all of that?
Just the same. There's a backlog of work. Be patient. We'll get onto it.
And how do you feel about being asked to be patient 3 years down the track?
Well, you run out of patience, don't you?
Right.
Yeah. But what else can you do?
Yes, well, let's take a music break. Declan, what have you got for us today?
Well, might help if I turn myself on first. I was speaking to Christine on the way in. I've got a song that she likes, thankfully. It's called Dreadlock Holiday from 10cc. Interesting thing about it is it's about a white man who gets lost in Jamaica, and it's inspired by real events, the guy that actually wrote the song. It gave 10cc the distinction of having three UK number one hits, all with different lead vocalists. So here we go. You're with Take It From Us Mental Health Radio, broadcasting every Tuesday from 12:30 to 1:30 right here on 104.6 Planet FM. And here is 10cc with Dreadlock Holiday.
Trucking right, I heard a dark voice beside of me, and I looked round in a state of fright. I saw four faces, one man, a brother from the gutter. They looked me up and down a bit and turned to each other. Would you like something holler?
She said, I've got it, you want it, my harvest is the best, and if you try it, you'll like it, and wallow in a dreadlock holiday.
Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And I'm host Sheldon Brown on Take It From Us with technician Declan Caron. And today we're talking to two advocates seeking justice from the, well, not only the coronial system or the legal system, but also the mental health system as well. We've got Corinda Taylor of Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust on the phone from Dunedin. And in the studio is Leanne Marshall, a bereaved parent with considerable experience of the mental health system. So, Leanne, I just wanted to go back to you in terms of some detail that you just shared in the music break, that your son was able to leave or escape an acute psychiatric unit, and he self-presented, which means he took the initiative to go to a police station.
Yes.
And what was the message he wanted to convey?
He told them that he was suicidal, that he wanted to take his life.
And so what happened from there?
They took him back to the mental health ward and nothing was done. He was able to escape and carry out what he said he wanted to do.
And how long from the time that he was taken back to that unit by the police and his escape? Again.
I think that was almost immediately, because I got a phone call, one phone call, to say that he was brought back. They called me within half an hour to say that he was missing again. So within that half an hour, he was gone again.
So what did you do when you got that phone call?
I was trying to call his phone, but apparently they'd taken it off him, so I was trying to call his phone. I was messaging him.
They didn't make you aware that he didn't have any way of contact?
No.
So, this lengthy period of 3 years trying to get answers, in that time you've taken a complaint against the police?
Yes.
And who was that investigated by?
The Independent Police Conduct Authority. And again, they investigated themselves.
And did they? What was the findings of that investigation?
My complaint was upheld, but they had found a scapegoat. There was a new policeman,
a rookie cop.
They used the rookie cop as their scapegoat, whereas it really should have been the senior policeman who was there.
Right. So what about the person who heard that he was suicidal at the police station? I mean, I suppose the police felt that they were doing the right thing. They were being responsible, taking your son back to the place where there should be care and safety.
Yeah, they basically just dropped him off and didn't hand over vital information about him wanting to take his life.
So when you consider that the police are the the front line of crisis mental health these days, and there's some staggering figures. I mean, I don't know them off, but I think there's over 100,000 people that are picked up by the police and taken. So that's people with mental health concerns.
Yes.
So they are the front line of the mental health service these days. So if they're not getting it right, how can we expect any sort of decent service?
Pretty much. I just think that both of these systems, like the DHB and the police, who we should be able to rely on to do the right thing, they failed badly.
Right.
I just wanted to dive in, if I can, then, because you might have mentioned this already, and with me with doing the technical, I might have missed it, but aside from the police and how they've handled it, have they explained how he managed to get out of there in the first place? What systems were deficient, or is this all still part of the inquiry?
It's still part of the inquiry. Like, they're very evasive when it comes to...
guarded and that. Yeah,
very guarded. That, like I said, they close ranks.
But doesn't that indicate to you that there's something seriously wrong when they can't just basically put it on a plate in front of you and say, this is what happened and, hey, we did wrong and we'll apologise right now?
Yeah, but they're saying that the coronial inquest will... they can't say or do anything until that's been completed.
It's a bit like throwing the hot potato, isn't it, to somebody else to handle.
Well, and it seems as though you can hide behind the fact that there aren't sufficient coroners. I think in your submission, the campaign that where you're looking to get some legal fairness, Corinda, you state in that there's only 17 coroners presently employed, plus a temporary replacement for a coroner who died in earlier this year. And I think your submission says that there should be 20 full-time coroners. Do you think that this is a critical factor in the delays?
Absolutely. I think, from memory, they've appointed 8 part-time coroners just to clear the backlog, and I think that is possibly to do with what has happened in Christchurch. However, I think 20 is not enough, not when many, many people face more than 2 years, and some as long as 5 years, and then ourselves more than 6.5 years. It will be close to 7 years when we have our inquest, and we're facing 7 days in court. Now, so here's the thing. In order for them to reduce the backlog, they changed the Coroner's Act and they removed the need for mandatory inquests for people who died in official custody. So it means like you really have to fight hard if you want an inquest, because they just want to do it all on paper. Now, if you do it on paper, then it becomes much easier to cover up failures of unexpected deaths. And it's easy to just paper over it. And especially if you, as a grieving family, don't have the legal support behind you, you will find it almost impossible to argue the point.
So you're caught between a rock and a hard place. If you can't afford that legal support, then what are you expected to do? Represent yourself?
Well, most families walk away because it's just too hard, and that's how it gets covered up.
So what happens if you get, you may know people that have got the findings of a coronial investigation, and what happens if you don't agree with that coronial investigation or conclusion?
I haven't got to that point yet.
No.
But I guess after an inquest, you can make submissions. I believe you can make submissions to the coroner and put your point across. I guess during an inquest, you will kind of get a feel for what is happening. But again, it comes at a huge personal cost if you have to do this without legal support. Look, these guys employ the top barristers in New Zealand to do a defensive inquest.
Now, all paid by the taxpayer.
Inquisitorial.
Right. All paid by the taxpayer.
Well, they argued, actually the insurance companies, but I mean the DHB uses taxpayers' money to pay the insurance company, isn't it? So here's the thing. If you go into, because we have to go and self-represent because we can't afford the lawyers. Now, these guys do this all the time. They are well versed in the process. They've got lots of financial support behind them. The insurance companies love it because they make heaps of money out of it. And we are the victims because we can't fight this. Imagine having to cross-examine the witnesses in a court, and you've never set foot in a court before, and you haven't studied law, and you haven't got any legal knowledge. They don't explain the processes. Mm. You don't know what to expect.
So what does this do to your grieving and your vulnerability, and I would imagine your frustration at a system which is failing?
The legal system is stacked against suicide bereaved families in whānau, and on top of that, we do not get free emotional support. There's no counselling for us, unlike victims of homicide, where I think Minister of Justice pays for 33 counselling sessions. We get none. So we can go and ask for 5 brief intervention sessions from your GP. Honestly, 5? That's not going to keep me alive.
And I think in an earlier interview on July the 23rd, you said that your husband had been getting counselling, but that counselling had ended, somewhat abruptly?
Yeah. So basically they are saying to him, you know, this is his lifeline. This is what's kept him alive all this time, being able to tap into counselling. They've now turned around and said, you don't have a mental illness, so we can't help you anymore.
So you have to have a mental illness after a tragedy like this and a family suicide. You have to qualify to have you qualify for counselling by having a mental illness. I mean, I'm surprised. Well, this would drive some people to mental vulnerability.
Absolutely.
I would have thought.
And we've become very vulnerable ourselves, but there's no support.
I would think that looking after people who have gone through trauma like that is equally as important in the mental health industry as somebody who's actually been diagnosed and going through something, because to me, dealing with a suicide would be equally as tragic as a homicide. There's only one element that's not involved, and to me, to basically put that barrier and separate the two is just unquestionable. It's like, what the heck's going on?
Exactly.
Why do you think there is a distinction? I mean, they're both tragic deaths, aren't they, and shocking deaths.
Well, I just wonder if this is the old stigma raising its head again, and whether basically we will have to fight for change, because if you don't fight for change, it's not going to happen. I think they just haven't thought about it.
So we've had this inquiry into mental health and addictions. We've had the outcomes. I think the government is going to support 38 of the 40 recommendations. One of them is that they're not prepared to put a target on reducing suicide in New Zealand. Did you make submissions to the inquiry into mental health and addictions in relation to this issue?
Absolutely, yeah. We spent 4 hours with the panel, the inquiry panel, and one of the submissions was the zero suicide system in healthcare, which means that we need to have systems in place that every death in the health system is preventable. And if somebody dies, then they go back and review and continuously review to look at what they can do better. They took away the target, but they haven't gone as far as to say that we will have a zero suicide system in place in our healthcare, which means we will not tolerate any suicides in the healthcare system. Like, I totally understand, and there's a big debate going on there, and lots of people misunderstand that, because yes, we can't prevent all suicides out in our community, but the moment somebody engages with the police services, they have to have the best systems in place so that we don't lose our loved ones to suicide.
Yeah, I think it's fantasy to talk about zero suicide. There's a group called GROW in the Hawke's Bay. We've interviewed the gentleman who heads up GROW, and he seems to have latched on to this sort of very catchy target of zero suicide. And they're also, I think, in the latest publicity about road safety and the road toll and the $1.4 billion they're going to spend on road safety, talked about a zero road toll. Leanne, have you got thoughts about this?
About the zero suicide?
Well, this, you know, sort of adopting a catchy target of zero suicide. I mean, given that our suicide totals are rising by about 10% a year.
Yeah, I think we need to aim for something, though, because clearly when you aim for nothing, what do you get? Nothing.
Right.
So, like, what Corinda was saying, about the accountability, there seems to be a lack of accountability, and that needs to actually happen, because you can't fix what you don't acknowledge.
Mm.
And it's very cold and clinical right from the beginning. You know, they're busy diagnosing and treating the problem rather than listening to the person. You know, the person is not defined by their mental illness, so there's lots of things that need to happen that would help bring those numbers down.
Right.
I think a lot of that too is to do with getting out there to people, away from the whole stigma thing. You know, if people are on drugs and that sort of thing, they can go and get drug treatment, but do they receive the same sort of stigma? I'm not too sure. And so if you've got somebody who's got suicidal thoughts, you've got that opportunity to get to them before they flip over the hurdle. And if you don't get people to a position where people at risk feel they can go to someone or to an organisation and don't feel like they're just going to be pushed aside, no one's going to come forward and mm-hmm. reduce that, you know.
Well, it was one of the worst examples of stigma was on TV3 last night, where they interviewed President Trump, and he said that these extremists who were killing people in America were all experiencing mental illness. So, you know, what chance have we got of normalising mental health when you've got the leader of the free world coming out publicly and saying that?
Yeah, that's pretty shocking.
I think he needs to clarify and expand on that, because my experience of looking at them is that couldn't be further from the truth. In most cases, there's other things behind it, but that's a story for another day.
I think it is. Let's take another music break, Declan.
Indeed, I'm bringing one up from that we've played before from Sia, Never Give Up. Thought it might be a good one today. Now, on the lyrics on this, you just got to, it's a bit tricky to kind of catch it. I think she says, I'll find my way home. So if it sounds like she's singing in Jamandi gibberish or something, well, she isn't. Yeah, we'll take it from us, Mental Health Radio, broadcasting here every Tuesday from 12:30 to 1:30 on 104.6 Planet FM. And here is Never Give Up from Sia.
To the sea, but she abandoned me. But I want.
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And that was Never Give Up by Sierra. I suppose both our guests might be thinking, well, am I going to give up, Leanne? I mean, have you got a goal to never give up on this, or are you just patiently sort of waiting?
Well, patiently waiting. I'm not getting too invested in the fight to, like, I am waiting at the moment. I don't want to invest any energy into fighting a battle that I can't win, so I'm waiting for the coronial process before I can proceed.
Right.
I don't know, Corinda's got more experience than me at fighting these things, and I take my hat off to you, Corinda.
Well, it's been a big battle, I must admit. We just knew it was just so wrong. Ross would be alive today had they done what they were supposed to do, because there were many missed opportunities in our case. And I have used up a lot of energy fighting something that was pointless, basically, because they just covered up so much.
Yeah.
So you are very wise to reserve your energy for when you will really need it. I mean, to me, it just sounds like they've really messed up badly. So
It sounds as though one of the positives is that you've established Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust, Corinda. So that's a positive outcome from the tragedy.
Well, it's a good distraction for me, because I think I was just so distraught, and I wanted to make a difference, and I couldn't save my own son, and I just thought to myself, you know, I just needed to connect with other people like Leanne. You know, I think there's strength in numbers. We can bounce ideas off each other. We can share our experiences. I mean, I don't even know if you know, Leanne, but you can request your son's medical notes from the DHBs. They make it extremely difficult for people to do that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have got the medical notes. They won't tell you to do that, of course.
I don't have them.
Sometimes reading those could be very traumatic as well, Corinda.
Very traumatic, I agree. And then you can request all those notes from your coroner. Now, in our case, we requested Ross's medical files. We requested it from the HTC as well, because we suspected that the file that they got was different to the file that we got. We've actually got three different versions of Ross's medical file. So, you know, you should... You know, you don't even know that the file that your coroner's got is even a complete file.
So when you say you've got three different files, what, from the one source? They've redacted.
Yeah, that's right.
Because really?
We got the original file, and then immediately we noticed there was information missing on file. Like, we made a few phone calls to the services, distressed calls to the services about our son's mental health. And those were missing from file. And so I went into the actual DHB and I asked to view the original medical file, which I did. And then I discovered even more pages that I asked to be copied. And my question to them was, why are our phone calls, our most distressed phone calls to you about my son's mental health, why are they not on file? And the person that's manager of the emergency services said to me, well, Corinda, you made too many phone calls.
Yeah, but that should be as important as noting what medication you've given a patient and when you visited them, really, because it's crucial to the whole component of it.
And you know, they know they have to include the families in the care process. They know that.
But it sounds as though they are sort of deliberately deleting anything where families are showing care and support for their patient.
Well, I can't say that. I'll get into trouble if I say that. All I can say is there's stuff missing on file.
Right.
And that's... I was just going to say, that's interesting, the Freedom of Information Act... when you request files and you see it on the news all the time and they're redacted. It's like, hang on a minute, if your case has not got anything to hide, why are you redacting all this information out of it that concerns me and my family? It's like, what's going on?
I mean, then you can go to the Privacy Commissioner and you can go to the Ombudsman. I mean, I've done all of that. I got hold of all sorts of information. I mean, that's a story for a whole other day. But there are ways and means to get the information. Like, first of all, they'll deny you to have your son's medical files. They'll go, oh, no, you need to be the executor of the estate. And chances are your son may not have had an estate. He may not have any money. And so they go, well, then you can't have the file. And then they'll go, you'll have to go for letters of administration. Now, you know, for bereaved families who may not have the means, it's complicated. And so most people give up and they don't get the letters of administration and becomes complicated to see the truth. You can request that information from the coroner, though. If you want to, you should.
The reality here is that these are supposed to be caring mental health and, you know, health organisations that we entrust to look after us. And when there is a dispute, that's when they become toxic and obnoxious and put up all these barriers to get any answers at all. Well, that's hardly caring and empathetic.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, there's no accountability in any case. So what does it matter if they admit that they've made a mistake? It makes no difference to them whether they admit it or not. There's no accountability in any case.
Well, I suppose there's a reputational issue. If they admit to a mistake, then their reputation could be tarnished. But I just wanted to ask you, Corinda, about your petition. We talked about that last week on Take It From Us, and you can access sort of analysis of your petition on Take It From Us on planetaudio.org.nz/Take It From Us. So you could source that interview. But yeah, how is your petition going?
So I have just been too busy to pay it any attention, and I haven't shared it around at all, you know, in the last month. But it's called Access to Justice for Suicide Bereaved Families in Whānau. And, you know, I have contacted Minister Andrew Little. I've emailed him 3 times. I've called his office once. And he has not once responded. So I'm not going to go away, and you know I'm kind of disappointed that he basically doesn't care about justice.
Yeah, he's a very busy man with the abortion legislation at the moment. So possibly right at this time, it's not the best time to be contacting the Minister of Justice, but it's disturbing that you haven't had any response. How can people access this petition? Have you got it online somewhere?
Yeah, I'll share it again on our Facebook page, and it can be found on lifematters.org.nz, our website, or our Facebook page, which is Life Matters NZ. I'll share it again today. Or they can go to change.org and just look it up, Access to Justice for Suicide Bereaved Families in Whānau. But, you know, honestly, I think, Leanne, the more of us that stick together and go public about this,
yes,
the better we can make change for other families. I mean, it's too late for our family. I don't think it's too late for your family. But I just hope you don't have to wait 6 years as well.
My view is that these delays around coronial inquests and, you know, conclusions it allows health authorities to continue to understate the number of suicides in New Zealand. And it staggers me that the Ministry of Health's website still claims that there are only about 500 suicides in New Zealand, when the provisional figures which were out earlier this year say that that figure has risen to 668. And even the Director of Mental Health and Addictions, Dr. John Crawshaw, in his latest report, talks about there being 500 suicides. Do you think that this is all part of a strategy to understate suicide, Corinda?
Absolutely. I mean, also, the Ministry of Justice is about 3 years or so behind with these statistics. You know, in the States, they are up to date. You know, I think these stats are out within a month.
Well, they hide behind these coronial delays, and so
the totals. It's all this paper shuffling, and it just delays necessary changes that can be made sooner. And the, you know, like, once you get to the truth, you can fix it.
Right. Well,
now you can get to the truth because, you know, there's all this legal stuff and paper shuffling going on.
I think you call it bureaucracy. thank you, Corinda. I just would like to ask Leanne for her sort of final comment before we come out of Take It From Us. So thank you very much again for your time, and all the best with that petition.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Leanne, anything that you'd like to say?
I'd just like to end it up with... hopefully a prevention for this happening to other families, or just a lessening of this happening to other families, that for wraparound services to be made more available right from the beginning.
So this is an intervention,
early intervention programs, which they're just starting to roll out now. Right. Had that have been available for my son, because you don't have to go through the assessment process, the waiting. They can get help immediately, and, you know, it's rather than an ambulance at the bottom of a cliff. It's that early intervention.
I mean, do you have any faith in acute psychiatric hospitals?
No, because when my son was first admitted, his first admission, this was his first admission, I didn't have any faith in the system at all, the clinical system. But I knew that once he got through that there'd be wraparound support available for him, and I was trying to get him through that gauntlet.
Through
that acute process, so that we could get wraparound support. But he never made that far.
So that's where the mental health system let him down very badly.
Yeah. I mean, the first clinical meeting I went to with the doctor, they were too busy diagnosing him and treating him, the problem, you know, rather than listening to him, because he was saying things like, I want to study, I want a career. But they didn't listen to that. So... you know, but I knew that if we got them through that acute process, we could get those wraparound supports, but they should be made available from the get-go.
Mm. Yes, well, thank you for your contribution. Have we got time for another music break? Or maybe
I
we'll
can
just
squeeze one in if you want.
We'll just go to community notices, I think.
Okay, hang one.
Take It From Us, Community Notice Board.
And Mental Health Awareness Week is a new date. It's earlier this year, and the Mental Health Foundation that is supervising and coordinating Mental Health Awareness Week put something out on Facebook this morning. So you can register for Mental Health Awareness Week and access posters and other resource material. The date is the 23rd to the 29th of September. This year, and the theme is Explore Your Way to Wellbeing. Pretty hard to explore your way to wellbeing when you've been facing the sorts of challenges and traumas that you've been experiencing, Leanne.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, like, obviously my faith in God is what's held me basically through this.
Right.
Like, I put all of my energy, like I said, into the beginning, getting all that information through to the coroner, and now it's just the waiting game. Yeah.
So you have a religious faith in God, which has supported you?
Pretty much, yeah. To me, he's held everything together, and I believe in justice, but I have to trust in him to bring that justice, because otherwise I'm expending energy. That's really, when you're coming up against a system like that, you know, I'm not afraid to challenge injustice wherever it is, but I want to do that wisely. You know, like my anybody that knows me knows that I'm a crusader for justice.
Right.
But when this happened, I just went really quiet, and I gave my focused attention to what mattered.
Right.
And patience, waiting.
Yeah, I think
justice will be had.
Right. Injustice and unfairness are the two things that really tend to get me very frustrated.
Isn't it funny, though, how the government tells you all your life, you can't do this, you can't do that, blah, blah, and so on and so on, and then when you actually go to them and go, I need help with this, it's like, oh, what do you want us to do? You know, it seems...
Yeah, well, they're covering their backsides, I think. That seems to be the situation.
I hope they've got a big sheet of corrugated iron, because it sounds like they're going to need it somewhere along the way.
Right. So we've got an interesting... this is related to suicide prevention. AOK, which is a suicide prevention organisation, has come up with a scrum. It's called Scrum Talk, and this is for families, coaches, teachers and peers. So you can look up on the website AOK to find out more about Scrum Talk, which is an interesting catchphrase for suicide prevention. So I think we've got a little bit more time.
You've got a few more seconds.
This Scrum Talk is delivered in a 1.5 to 2-hour workshop, and there's a very famous rugby league player, Ali Lauatiti, who is going to share his 20-plus years of professional rugby league experience for young people that are coming up in sport and who have to face the challenges of life. So thank you. That's Take It From Us. And thank you to Leanne as well.
Thank you, Sheldon.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, I'll catch you next week.